Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You have to be careful if you type surfing into YouTube. You get nearly 3 million hits, and once you start watching, you can easily lose hours. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. All my surfing is done online. And to be candid, I've always been impressed by the sport, but I don't think I could really understand the hold it had on people who fell in love with it. William Finnegan's book changed all that for me. It's a memoir of half a century of surfing, from California and Hawaii to Australia, Africa, Fiji, even the waters off Long Island. It's also a story of the ways that surfing has bonded and tested his relationships and shaped his understanding of himself. William Finnegan is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book is called Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life. Bill, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
You write that there may have been a sacred element to the first surfing. Do we know anything definitive about the origins of this?
Well, we know that surfing was incredibly popular in Hawaii, you know, pre-contact with the West. There are descriptions from Captain James Cook onward of Hawaiians in the water, sort of frolicking, half-dressed, and the rituals that surrounded the shaping and sort of bestowal of certain, you know, high-quality surfboards. But it seems to have been a really, really sort of cross-the-board pastime in Hawaii. You know, men, women, commoners, royalty, everybody took off work when the surf was good.
You can relate to that.
Yep.
I guess any day of surfing starts with an evaluation of the weather and of the ocean itself. How much of what you need to know can you only determine once you're on shore looking at the conditions?
Well, I've been at it a long time. As you said, I've been surfing for about 50 years. And once upon a time, I just went and looked at it. I had no idea if it was going to be big, small, good or bad. But forecasting has improved and improved. And at this point, I live in Manhattan and surf locally. Long Island and north part of the Jersey Shore get quite good, especially in winter. And I don't know how we did it before we had the internet with all these, you know, they have surf cams showing you what the waves are doing at that moment on online and all kinds of sophisticated wind and weather and ocean, you know, swell forecasting and so that you try to nail down exactly when it might be good and race down there and meet it. I don't know how I could have done this version of surfing without all this technology.
You surfed just before Hurricane Irene made landfall?
I did just before it came ashore and the surf was even better just after it kind of pushed inland. That was a really good, I mean, it's terrible on the East Coast especially. The surfers are wait gleefully for hurricanes, which, you know, tear up the Caribbean and sometimes tear up the U.S. mainland as well. And surfers are just kind of ghoulishly rubbing their hands about when the waves are going to get big and when they're going to get good. And I must admit, I'm part of that.
Can you talk us through briefly what it is you're doing when you're out there? You sort of paddle out, you catch a wave. Can you tell us how you do that and what the sort of steps are?
Well, it's you study the lineup a little bit if you need to, see what it looks like. You jump, you put on a wetsuit if you need it, if it's cold. You wax the surface of your board so that it'll stick under your feet, not slide. And then jump in the water and paddle out, which can be simple and straightforward, and you can get out with your hair dry, or it can be, you know, a grueling process or even a failure that drives you back onto shore, depending on sort of what you're facing in the way of oncoming waves. And then once you're out there, it's to get to the right spot to wait or to sort of intercept waves that are coming in. And that involves reading waves, which is really more of what surfing is about than riding them. I mean, you need to be able to read waves well before you ever start surfing. And that's the kind of ongoing, I don't know if I would call it work, but that's the thing you're really, really engaged in, is trying to understand what the ocean is doing at any given point. which often means trying to understand one little patch of coast, you know, the place where you usually surf, the place where you're a local, to get that break wired, as we say, it's a long-term, kind of like a longitudinal study, a sociologist might say, of the spot in all conditions of wind and tide and swell angle and swell interval and swell size, and every these combinations get pretty complex and kind of ineffable at a certain point. You can't really explain it, but to really understand what a place is doing is really the main thing surfers are doing. You glance out and see them at the end of your street if you're near the coast, and they seem to be just playing out there, but everybody's quite deeply engaged in this effort to understand.
It seems like one of those things that people get wrong about surfing and surf culture. You know, the idea is from dumb TV shows and movies that surfers are kind of, half a joint
dumb.
In at all times and not very smart. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Well, there's plenty to that stereotype. You can find the guys broing down all over the world, actually, at this point. But everybody who surfs, however, you know, accomplished or impressive on land or otherwise, is engaged in this same business of trying to understand it. And surfers have these endlessly technical and detailed conversations that nobody outside surfing would ever understand. But trying to explain or begin to figure out what's going on at a given spot at a given time.
When you've caught a wave and you're up on your board, and I know I'm going to be using all the wrong terminology here, and I hope that you'll be patient with me. where is your attention? What are you thinking about? And do you have to be sort of mentally loose, like you're physically loose, and yet alert enough to any kind of unexpected change that comes along?
That's actually a good description of, it depends. If you're a very experienced surfer, you started young and you stayed at it and are reasonably good, there's a lot you don't need to think about that's automatic, you know, sort of nerve memory. And then if you know a spot well, there's all the things you can sort of anticipate that you wouldn't be able to do if you didn't know. So your attention shifts. I mean, if you're at a new spot, you're watching very, very closely. What's this wave going to do? What's this wave going to do? And watching all the signs of how the water's moving out in front of you and how the water's moving across the reef, what you can see to get signals like that. And you need those same signals at a place you know. But if you know a place well, you're sort of confident about what they all mean. You're not having to question them at every moment. And generally, of course, you're looking a bit ahead. And if everything's very much under control and it's a good wave, you're looking well ahead and sort of planning maneuvers ahead of time. Although some of the best surfers, not only do they surf really hard and you know, turn very hard and pull off spectacular maneuvers and get barreled, you know, get pulled into the wave and get the wave to break all the way over them. That's kind of the ultimate thing you're looking for. But they're also very, very spontaneous. I mean, you can see them reacting much more quickly than anybody else to kind of changes inside the wave. And that's, I mean, there's this sort of deep intelligence. It's not just athletic intelligence. It's kind of ocean understanding that goes with the best surfers. What other surfers marvel at is less the kind of physical feat or athletic feat than it is how did he know that? How did he know the wave was going to do that? How did he understand it was the time to do that? So there's a whole sort of rapid fire calculation you make while you're surfing, and it varies from wave to wave and surfer to surfer, of course.
I was fascinated in the book to read how much surfers learn by watching one another, and you tell this story as a kid, hearing that somebody that you had idolized admired a move that you did well. It's something that literally stuck with you for the rest of your life.
Yeah, that was a guy named Glenn Kalakakui. He was a year older than me. We moved to Hawaii when I was 13. I was already a fairly hardcore surfer, but it was really just a dream to live in Hawaii then. For a while, my dad got a job there, and I befriended these brothers, the Kalakakuis. Roddy Kalakakui is my age. Glenn was a bit older and a really, really good surfer, and so he was sort of a hero of mine. And I was in a little contest, and he was one of the judges. And it was funny, afterward, I'd got a second place in the contest, and he said, each time you do that drop knee cutback, blah, blah, I give you big points, you know. And I said, really? That dropped? Because that was a very sort of cold water, stiff sort of white boy mainland maneuver that I was sort of planning to get rid of. You really didn't need it in Hawaii. I was trying to sort of take on more of the island style that Glenn and his brothers and the other guys I was surfing with there had, which was a revelation to me. But he said, you know, oh, yeah, I mean, he'd never seen that before, and he liked it. And so I said, all right, that's it. The drop knee cutback stays.
Hawaii was, in many ways, not what you expected. On the one hand, you knew it would be like a surfer's paradise, but the surf was different. The social conditions were different from what you had expected.
Yeah, I had, like all surfers, been, I was sort of steeped in the images of Hawaii in surf magazines and surf movies, and it's all, you know, big, beautiful blue waves with offshore winds. And so we moved and lived in a cottage near the beach on the backside of Diamond Head, and it was all different color and crummy waves and crummy winds, and the water smelled strange. And everything was, yeah, it was real life, not the magazine fantasies. But I really got to love the spot out front of a paddle down from where we live called Diamond Head Cliffs. And life on land, yeah, was quite a bit different. I was in junior high school, and my parents just sent me off. They didn't even know where the school was, really. It's, you know, it's off in that direction. I have younger siblings, and they went off to elementary school. And in those days, this is the mid-60s, California public schools were really great, and we'd all gone to California public schools, and my parents didn't really check out what it might involve to show up at a Hawaiian public school in those days. And they were not so great. There was private schools for people who could possibly afford them, and we didn't know anything about it. And so the school I went to was really kind of tough. It was all ganged up, and it was kind of racialized. I'd grown up in a kind of white bread Los Angeles suburb, and suddenly I was in a school where, like, white kids known as Howleys were a small minority and much disliked. And there were all these gangs of, you know, Samoans, Hawaiians, Filipinos. The Howleys also had a little gang. And it was lots and lots of fighting. And it was sort of jumping in the deep end to a world of, diversity and a fair amount of friction.
So how did things go? You had Hawaiian friends that you surfed with after school and before school and on the weekends. What happened when you saw them across the cafeteria Monday morning?
Yeah, it was a bit of a surprise. I met these guys in the water, the Kalakaua brothers and a friend of theirs, a Japanese guy named Fort Takara. We were big buddies. They kept their boards at my house. We surfed every day together. And for the longest time, I never asked them where they went to school. And it turned out they went to the same school I went to. And by then, I had been invited into this little white kid gang, this little Howley gang that called themselves, unbelievably, the In Crowd. And so I said yes, yes, and jumped into the gang to, you know, somebody would have my back, and they did. And actually, my fighting career kind of tailed off then, which was a happy outcome. But then I began to realize that my buddies went to the school there, and I felt kind of split. Oh, no, you know, my best friends are these white kids called mokes, you know, kind of a derogatory term for dark-skinned people. And I just thought, oh, no, how's this going to work? And in the end, it sort of worked out fine. I mean, I kind of scuttled around with Rade Kalakaua'i for a while, and then at some point, they just started hanging around with this little gang under their monkey pod tree. And the gang was integrated with, like, no fuss at all. I mean, it wasn't sort of doctrinaire racist white gang at all. It was just kind of situational, really.
My guest is...
And this guy, Glenn Kalakaua'i, was so cool, nobody could resist him. Sorry.
That's okay. I'm glad you added that in. My guest is William Finnegan. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he has a new memoir out called Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life. We'll resume our conversation in 2 minutes. You can join the conversation at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New Yorker staff writer William Finnegan. His new memoir is called Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Bill, surfing magazines were a big part of your youth, and certainly they informed your attachment to the sport and who you followed and what you paid attention to. Was there anything about the writing in them that you think had an influence on the sort of writer you would ultimately become?
No. In a word, not a bit. They were really all about the photos and the captions. I mean, a well-turned caption was important, but it wasn't a type of writing that I mean, the articles were not really that important. It's funny you should ask my dad. When I was always writing from an early age, and when I was probably 14 or 15, he was urging me to write an article for one of the surf magazines. He'd supply the photos, he said. It was this ongoing argument. I'd say, you don't understand. You would never be able, no matter what you did, to take a photo they'd be interested in. You'll never reach that level of surf photography. And he'd say, no, you're just scared. You write it. Don't worry. The photos are – and he's right. I was scared to try to write for publication. I didn't have any story to tell. And it was a sort of ongoing argument, and that article never happened.
Have you ever seen a movie, a TV show, some video presentation that came even close to duplicating what it feels like, what it looks like, what it sounds like to be out there on your board?
No. That is, I've never seen a mainstream feature or TV show, no, or even really documentary that gets at it right. I mean, they tend to be really corny and kind of missing the main part of what surfing is and what happens in the world of surfing. But that said, there are lots of surf movies, hardcore surf movies of no interest probably to anybody who doesn't surf, some of which are fantastic, but it's, you know, it's sort of within the tribe. You know, it's news what somebody is doing, or a wave you've never seen before, or how somebody is riding a certain wave, and really beautiful footage, really, you know, sort of epic sessions that were recorded. And but that's, as I say, very hardcore form and not for the uninitiated usually.
Watching all those surf videos that I saw recently, there are some where the waves are just crowded with people. They're like poppy seeds on a bagel on these waves. And I wonder if that just destroys the experience.
Yeah, it can. Crowds are a huge problem in surfing now, an increasing problem, and drive many of us to travel to the ends of the earth to find uncrowded waves. I mean, that's a big part of surfing now, and it's kind of always been part of my surfing life to try to find waves with no people. I spent about half my 20s in the Southern Hemisphere basically looking for waves that had not been ridden before.
Was there more to it? I mean, you were traveling, you were meeting people, you were having experiences, you were teaching for a while. Did you understand that your motivation was really about surfing, or did you think surfing is something I'm able to do as I go to these places and I'm kind of becoming the person I'm becoming?
That's a good question, because it's true. I mean, in retrospect, I can say I was on this hunt for waves, and that hunt did very much determine where I went. My friend and I went this island to that island, to Australia, to Asia, to Africa. But, and, you know, working jobs along the way to be able to do it. And yet at the time I was a surfer, but that's not how I thought of myself. I thought of myself as a writer, and surfing was just this thing I had done since I was a kid, to which I gave very little thought. I mean, lots and lots of energy, but the journals that I relied on heavily to write this memoir don't have that much surfing in them. Everything else, the books I'm reading, the, you know, girls I'm agonizing over, all this stuff about writing. But surfing, I wanted that big trip after grad school, and it saved a bit of money. And it just sort of felt mandatory. I didn't even think it through. Am I really going to do this with my life? It was just, at a certain age, you have to go around the world looking really seriously for waves. It was kind of an unconscious dog whistle kind of existence. And it was only in my 30s when I first wrote something for The New Yorker. I was by then freelancing and soon to join the staff of The New Yorker and a political journalist. I mean, I should mention that most of my so-called career has been writing about politics, very broadly defined, you know, about conflict and power and injustice, mainly in the developing world. So I did some training for that sort of work by living in the developing world, looking for waves and kind of roughing it among poor people in different parts of the global South. And in retrospect, one could see that, and I'd interview people and fill my journals with these interviews with, you know, just some Indonesian soldier I met. What is this doing here? I wasn't planning to write about him. But I was doing a kind of proto long-form journalism, the sort of stuff I do for The New Yorker. But it wasn't until I actually wrote something for The New Yorker about surfing in the early 90s that I began to think this is not just, this relic of childhood that I can't seem to get rid of, this sort of addiction that nags at the edges of my life. This is actually part of my life and led me to start thinking seriously about accounting for this part of my life. And finally, I've written this book.
That piece, we should say, is reproduced in the book. I don't know if it's exactly the same, but it's worked into the,
no,
into
it's
the
not.
Narrative. But people just went crazy for it. And it was kind of, I gather, a career changer for you, but one that you hesitated initially to publish because you thought, I'm going to lose all my credibility if people know that this serious conflict and political journalist is also like a surfer dude.
Yes, there was that hesitation. I mean, it was funny how this book had a weird genesis in that sense. I was freelancing, living in San Francisco. I sent The New Yorker a short political piece. First thing I'd sent them, just sent it over the transom, and they took it. And someone in the editor's office said this would be a good time to propose something longer. And I didn't have an idea, and I thought I had 15 minutes. And I just quickly said, how about a profile of this guy I'm surfing with, this kind of charismatic doctor, big wave surfer in San Francisco. And I got the assignment. And then had to write it and hesitate. Well, it took me 7 years to write, so you know, missed a couple deadlines. and one of the there were various, and I did a lot of. I mean, I published 3 books in that 7 years. I wasn't doing nothing else, and I moved to New York and I joined The New Yorker. But finishing that surfing piece did have this. One of the inhibitions was a nervousness about coming out of the closet as a surfer. This stereotype of that you've mentioned and we've talked about is, you know, I thought, because I was writing a lot of political opinion columns at the time, that in the sort of policy debates I was locked in, I could just imagine people throwing this in my face. Oh, you're just a dumb surfer, you know. Why do we have to listen to you? And which didn't happen. I mean, nobody seemed to pay any attention at all. But it didn't really change. I mean, it made me. That didn't change my career so much. I kept plugging along, doing the kind of work I had been doing after that piece came out, although it got a lot of attention. But in discussions with my publisher, should they bring this out as a book, me saying no, them, you know, saying why not, I ended up kind of proposing this book, you know, a fuller memoir about other places and other people I'd surfed with and a kind of fuller picture of the whole thing. And in that sense, yes, but you know, up till now, all my books have been, you know, journalism about big serious issues. So this is a big break from that.
Surfing seems to make for complicated relationships.
It does, and it makes for very powerful, for me anyway, these really vivid friendships that form around surfing. You know, this thing you have in common, and you're chasing waves, and you're pooling knowledge all the time, and going through whatever privations to find waves, and competing with each other, and trying to understand spots, learning spots together. So writing about surfing ends up, for me, being writing a lot about male friendship. As it happens, all the people I've been closest to and surf with have been other guys. More and more women are surfing now, and more seriously, some really, really good women surfers now. I've only seen videos. I've never surfed with any of these great women surfers, but they surf better than 95% of men. But it isn't not been part of my experience, really. It's been a sort of guy thing, and so I write a lot about that in the book.
Your wife is not a surfer.
Yes, most of the women in my life have been actively indifferent to surfing. And my wife is from Zimbabwe and a landlocked country, right. and could never see it at all. Although she's, you know, seen me go through plenty of things, bad experiences and great experiences, and she sometimes has come and stayed in these remote, odd corners of the world. I used to spend a lot of time in Madeira, Portuguese island, out in the middle of nowhere, way out in a village in the middle of nowhere in Madeira, and she'd come and sort of gamely spend some time there. But no, she's not interested. I can't even get her. She's never taken a picture of me surfing. I can't even get her to watch me surf.
I was thinking as I was reading about the freedom that you had as a young teenager, and I gather even before that, to sort of learn how to surf and be out there, and your parents assumed you'd be fine, you knew how to swim. This is not the way we run the world today, and you have a daughter of your own, and I take it you're more protective over her than you probably would have wanted anyone to be over you at the same age.
I think that's true. She's 13 now, and I make a real effort, we both do, to let her have her independence. We live in Manhattan, so kids can't run so free. I mean, you can't jump on your bike and ride down the street. You'll get run over by a taxi cab. But we make a real effort to let her have her independence and have some agency in the world, trying to, you know, helicopter over her too much. But when I look back at how I was raised and my siblings and a lot of my friends, too, in California and Hawaii in the 60s, I think that most of the parents would be arrested today for the just sheer, you know, laissez-faire. What I was 13, 14, hitchhiking long distances with surfboards and really left home very young, a little too young. But our parents just had a large amount of faith in our ability to watch out for ourselves. And it only seems outrageous in retrospect.
We have an email here from Tom, who, by the way, says he started surfing in 1964, still surfing today, training for frequent surf trips, been all over Central America, Mexico, California, Hawaii, New Zealand, Morocco, Fiji. Tom wants asks this, surfers have always been known as vagabonds with little career drive. Has this changed and has surfing become respectable?
I often hear that it has. A surfer the other day said to me, he was actually interviewing me, but a hardcore surfer, mm-hmm. said, "Barbarian days. Why are you calling it that? Surfing like nestles between yoga and golf nowadays." He says, you know, all the juvenile delinquency is gone. And I think there's some truth to that, although a bit of an exaggeration too. And the title refers to a kind of overarching metaphor in the book, not bad behavior on the part of, you know, individual surfers. But, there seems to be, there's certainly a large class of mostly middle-aged surfers who have kind of hung on to it, like Tom and me, and you know, older even than that, and who have jobs and careers and have enough money to afford, you know, surf trips all over the world, including, you know, expensive charter boat trips in Indonesia and such places. And they didn't used to... I mean, those charter boats didn't used to exist, and there was no customer base. So I don't know about more respectable. Yeah, it is. You see high schools with teams, and that was always more true in, say, Australia, where it was more organized and a kind of an approved sport than in the U.S. But you see that sort of thing in the U.S. now. When I was in high school, I mean, our high school would sooner have expelled us or seen us in jail than offered us a team. I mean, we were bad boys. We were rebels, which is to say we were cool. But beach towns, too, I'm not sure on the Gulf, but on the East Coast and West Coast, both, there were towns that banned surfing, and it was very easy to get arrested. Beach cops really harassed surfers when I was young. And I think that's much less true now, so I fear that it's true we're getting more respectable.
You write that for a long time, I guess the surfing itself was enough of a workout. You were able to do it often enough. And then you got to a point where you had to start swimming so that you would feel in condition every time you had a day when you could take your board out.
Yeah, I think I was fooling myself and thinking that I would never need to, you know, go to a gym or swim in a pool or anything like that. And then in middle age, I started surfing bigger waves, actually, in my 40s, in Madeira in particular. and really getting pummeled and didn't have the strength I needed to surf waves that serious, and finally, you know, buckled under the grim fact of having to, especially I live in New York and go, I can't surf every day or every week, and there are patches when I just, you know, dissolve into blubber, I hate to think, if I didn't swim and finally, you know, started lifting. I'd never touched a barbell, I don't think, till I was in my mid-40s. But since then, alas, I've had to do some land training, so I'm ready to go to surf when the waves are good and when I can get away.
Is your balance different today than it was when you were younger and less experienced, but younger?
I think my balance is getting worse, I'm sorry to say. I mean, surfing, as you get older, is this terrible, you know, deterioration of your skills. There's no, you try to disguise it various ways, but I mean, your strength, your quickness is just going. You're, as surfers would say, you're becoming a kook again, which is a horrible thing to go through. You try to get, you know, a heavier board that floats you better to sort of disguise that fact. But I also think my balance is getting worse. I've messed up my ankles surfing, so they're a little stiffer than they used to be. And you can one of the downsides of serious surfing is you can really sort of, I mean, I messed up my skin, my eyes, my ears, I don't know what all else, but everything that's wrong with me seems to be from surfing. and I feel like my balance is not what it was. On the other hand, you're smarter. I mean, you surfed a long time, you know how to compensate. You know how to read waves well. You just don't necessarily know how to respond. I mean, you can't physically respond to them as quickly as you once could.
William Finnegan is my guest. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the new memoir, Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with The New Yorker's William Finnegan, author of the new memoir, Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life. Join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Bill, surfing seems really territorial in some ways. Can you talk about the process of, do you have to earn the privilege of surfing particular waves that lots of other surfers really covet?
Yes, just that. I mean, popular waves, good waves, usually have a sort of local crew who live there and surf them all the time. And there's usually a strong pecking order within that group. And if you're new to the place or you don't surf there all the time, you're having to try to sort of punch your way into that order so you can get waves. I mean, people are clever about you know, sort of dominating the surf. There are only so many waves, and these days at a lot of places there are too many surfers. So that this kind of simian dance, the kind of, you know, who's going to be the alpha surfer out there at any given day, at any given moment, is a strong part of surfing. It's not that much discussed because people are all very engaged in it, but it's a little embarrassing to explain to people on land.
The danger of surfing have any relationship to its appeal? Is danger just something that you have to accept if you want to do this thing you love, or is that part of the reason that it's so exhilarating?
I think for most of us, it is part of the reason, although it, you know, one can surf at all different levels, and there are plenty of surfers who are not interested in waves that are the least bit dangerous and sort of stay away from them. and others who, I mean, big wave surfers who are kind of a separate breed, who go into unbearably, just unbelievably dangerous situations and that no one else would get near. And then there's everything in between. And everybody who surfs sort of has their upper limit, you know, waves that are as heavy as they want to get near. And those of us who want to sort of surf in that level, you know, where it's dicey, but it could be great. That the exhilaration has everything to do with getting that close to, you know, quite violent waves and but not too close and sort of pulling it off. But the thing, at least speaking for myself, and I think this is true for most serious surfers, the thing that you are going toward is this experience of beauty, you know, this really drenching experience of beauty if you're successful. And the danger is just, you know, a hair's breadth away. It's just on the other side of that. But really those risks are kind of the footnotes. That's not what you're thinking about at all. You're thinking about what you're trying to get in, that is inside the wave and get next to and sort of be pierced by almost.
So is the beauty about what your body's doing and how it feels? Is it about what you see as you're there, either on top of or inside the wave?
It's both those things. Definitely a physical sensation. I won't call it orgasmic, but really, you know, deep in your bones, a good wave feels incredibly good. And it's also what you see. Sometimes some of the more dramatic waves, you get hit in the head, but you don't fall off. You're back in such a position that you really can't see much. It's all so sort of mist and spray and white water. And then you come out and you hardly saw what happened. Others, it's very, very clear. And time famously seems to slow down and you get this sort of vision, this view from deep in a wave that you pretty much never forget. So it's both those things. And usually, you know, like a really good wave, a great wave is the culmination of years and years of effort, you know, getting to understand a spot, getting the sort of skill and ability and nerve to be there, and then the luck to be there and to pull it off. So it's physical and visual and I dare say spiritual.
I would imagine that as a surfer, someone who grows up loving this thing and perfecting your skills, you probably thought you knew what that orgasmic experience was before you actually had it for the first time. And I wonder if you can talk about, do you remember a particular experience where you thought, oh, wait, I everything I've done before has been nothing compared to this?
Not really. I write about in the book this sort of levels of ascendance or transcendence as one goes. And when I first surfed, it was the style was like nose riding, hanging five, hanging 10 was a big part of surfing. And I was kind of a skinny little nimble kid, so I could do that. And so those like really, you know, great nose rides. But that started to change as boards got shorter. There was something called the shortboard revolution in 1968. Boards changed quite dramatically. And the sort of style nose riding disappeared. And the whole objective of surfing became much more to sort of get deeper in the belly of the wave. And I remember the first few good little barrels I got, those were in Hawaii, were each kind of revelations. But there wasn't one that stood out above all the others. And then I got into better waves and better waves. I actually dropped out of college to pursue a wave on Maui, Hawaiian outer island, a place called Honolulu Bay that I'd kind of fallen in love with and just wanted to live for, and then I got some waves out there that were a completely new level of speed and depth and beauty and it went from there. I eventually surfed some of the best waves in the world in Australia and South Africa, and especially in the South Pacific. A friend and I found a wave off an uninhabited island where we camped, it was the best wave either of us had ever seen, and we camped there for quite a while and just surfed it to a fairly well, and there were waves there that I describe in some detail in the book that were perhaps the the ones you're thinking of, but it had been, I don't know how many years, 15 years at least, to get to those.
That was such an astonishing discovery for you, and now it's not so undiscovered.
No, it was, as I say, we found it. A couple of guys had surfed it before us off a yacht, a couple of American guys. We heard about it, and we got some local fishermen, this is in the west side of Fiji, to take us out to the island and come back each week. There was no fresh water, so we needed resupplies. And we just waited on it, and it was just a remarkable, remarkable wave, very shallow coral reef, and unusual configuration with the wind and the swell. But and we meant to keep it a secret, and a few other guys, we stopped on yachts that came off yachts, Australians, a couple of Americans that year. So there were a few guys who knew about it, and we were determined to keep it a secret. And we all had this big vow of silence. And my friend Brian and I thought that the secret was being kept, but then a few years later picked up a surf magazine, and there it was splashed all over the cover. And not only had the secret got out, but a couple of American surfers had managed to lease the island from the Fijian government and build a resort there and get exclusive access to the waves and this kind of high-end surf camp. So that was a bit of a blow.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Carl on the line in Dallas. Hi, Carl.
Good afternoon.
Hi, go right ahead.
Well, two things. I said first about the sanctioned activities. I grew up in Cocoa Beach, Florida in the 60s, and we actually, the last 2 years, I graduated in 70, the last 2 years of my high school, Brevard County did have organized, sanctioned high school surfing teams. And so, because you had mentioned that they weren't around.
Yeah.
That was something,
you guys,
I don't know how long they lasted, but they were there.
It sounds like you guys were way ahead of us. Sorry.
And the other one, and an old guy, like I said, and thought you brought my memories back about being pretty free about how long you could go and where you could get away to. Having raised kids in this generation and now I have grandkids, I really miss them having the opportunities that you and I had growing up.
Mm. Yeah, you wonder the sort of more fearful parenting, as I see it, of the current generation. You wonder if it's really necessary. Is there some objective reason why life's more dangerous now than it used to be? I mean, I don't believe there is, but I suppose others would argue that you know, the world's more dangerous than it used to be.
What are the challenges of trying to write for readers who live and breathe surfing, who may have been to many of the places you write about and had similar experiences, and also trying to describe this thing you love for those of us who have never even touched a surfboard?
Ah, well, I very much write for the general reader. I mean, that's what I've been doing at The New Yorker for, God, 30 years. And this book's very much for the general reader, not somebody who knows surfing. And I, in the first chapter, I'm careful to kind of explain the various sort of ocean technical terms or surfing technical terms that you'll encounter in the book, not with a glossary or anything, but each one is explained. And in the course of the story in that first chapter about me being a little kid in Honolulu. And after that, I think that readers are pretty much oriented and know where they are and know what's going on when there are surf scenes that if they hadn't got that kind of introduction, that might have been lost in. But it is a trick to write both for hardcore surfers who would be interested in a lot of the stuff in this book, I think, and seem to be interested, and for the general reader. There's a kind of narrow path between the two that I'm trying to stay on. And it's pretty easy, actually, to keep surfers engaged. I don't really worry about that because I'm one of them and I'm writing about what interests me and it tends to be that what interests me is also what interests them. But it's the general reader I'm attending to all the time, you know, trying to keep them oriented and give them a stake in the outcome of a given surf session, say, or anything. I mean, it's only a minority of the book, I would say, that takes place in the water, probably, you know, a small percentage really, but there is that problem of writing for a specialist audience that is looking for something really informative and almost technical and writing for everybody else and keeping them engaged. I keep hearing from readers and somewhat from reviewers, but this book's not about surfing. I love to hear. You know, it's about men. It's about love. It's about obsession. You know, it's about how to live. I love hearing all these things because it is. It's an autobiography, basically, and it's about a lot of things, and it's also about surfing.
It did debut at number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list, so congratulations on that.
Thank you. Yeah, people seem to be reading it.
Okay, we have an email here. Maybe this is a perfect one to finish up on. Hayden is a recent convert to surfing, says, I only started at age 38 when I moved to Lima, Peru for a job. What struck me and continues to keep me hooked about surfing was not its physical pleasures, but its spiritual dimension. And that's something that you alluded to earlier.
Mm. Well, getting out in the water, particularly, I don't know what that person's situation is in Lima, but in New York, for instance, where I have a fairly high-pressure job. I mean, it's quite flexible, but still, it's a real job. And the main guys I surf with there, my main surf partner these days is a Broadway dancer, and he's got quite an intense job. And the break you get by getting out in the ocean and very much getting on the ocean's timetable is you feel pretty deeply. I mean physically, if it's cold water, which it often is, because waves are the best in the winter around New York, you get this kind of deep exhaustion because you get cold and you get tired and then you warm up and the kind of afterglow of, especially if the waves are good, obviously, is there's something beyond a ordinary workout. It can feel pretty transcendent. And if you don't surf since you're a kid, I mean, if you take it up as an adult, you're not probably going to attain the kind of athletic mastery that allows you to bask in how well you surf. That won't be it. It'll be much more the kind of joys of being out in the water with all, the birds and fish and changing conditions and the sort of beauty and to be frank, the struggle that comes with that. That often the kind of not fun part of surfing, the frustrating and scary and annoying and boring and the rest of it, often hasn't really been written about. And I try to make sure that readers of this book understand that the experience is well-rounded, full of glum stuff among the fun.
William Finnegan is a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the new memoir, Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life. Bill, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.